Christ is risen, happy Easter, and may the true blue dream of sky and the leafing greenly trees, all that is natural, all that is yes, bless you today and always. In the words of the poet E.E. Cummings. It's true that things coming to life around us put us in that mode for renewal of life. But spring's been really slow to come this year, don't you agree? And it's still kind of cold out there, and it lurches forward unevenly, as did, in fact, that first Easter. It didn't come as a shabam moment for many people. It actually came as a slow dawning, even a vibrational thing, over time. The gospel writers give us different versions. Matthew starts the scene of Easter with a great earthquake. But for John, Easter starts as a muted, modest beginning. Just a few grieving women show up. Nothing much going on there. One man, calmly collected, gives them a message. Go and tell the disciples, and Peter especially, go tell them to go to Jerusalem, to go to Galilee. And you'll see Jesus there who's gone before you. There's no mention here that this is good news, that it's a joyful occasion. There's no alleluias. Instead, the women take off, scared, astonished. And we don't know the end of the story, because actually that's where Matthew ends. The rest are some add-ons by those of us who like to have complete endings. You know, like when you pick up a story and you're going through a hard time and you want to read a satisfying conclusion. That's why historical romances are written, in my opinion. But anyway, we have Mark's gospel to deal with this morning, and we wonder, what were those women thinking and dealing with? Recently, a Viennese choir recorded a rather unusual version of Handel's Messiah. Instead of a thundering, triumphant, cymbal-crashing climax, it's a little different. It's a bit muted, a hesitant style that says human beings can only dimly see and longingly hope that God is wresting forward victory out of suffering, chaos, and captivity. As music critic Porter Anderson put it, it is almost as if the singers were in a dream, sometimes sitting bolt upright, then drifting back to a pianissimo of heartbreaking faith, something that aches, longs, and needs. Well, Easter weekend is a mix of that for all of us. Something in us aches, longs, and needs. You know what it is. And it's also about hopes and dinners and eggs and Seder and Passover, too, this year, where I was last night, looking for that afikomen, the broken matzah around the house. It's about pranks and bunnies and maybe drives in the country. Some of you are playing with grandchildren, and others of you are going back to a hospital bed to wait for news. Some of you are living in the new normal. It's become a favorite saying around here. The new normal of an unexpected health episode and some uncertainty about what comes next. Some of you have dealt with an unexpected transition. You've lost your job, that anchor in your routine. Or the world is shaken up in a way we hadn't predicted. It's disorienting when patterns we count on to keep us going come to an end and we think, well, now what? The women had that on their minds too, but first, their minds were on a practical question. In the event of a death or an emergency, perhaps fortunately there are practical things to do just to get us through it. So of course, they had to find spices to go to the tomb to finish the business of anointing. And a very practical question is on their minds, not a metaphysical question. Who will roll away the stone that blocks the entrance to the tomb? Who indeed will roll away the stones of grief that can hang unresolved on our chests for years? who can roll away the stones that block what we want to flower in our own lives? We don't know. Well, in fact, sometimes the blocks are our own stubborn patterns and resistance. This is what Mark thinks of the male disciples. Make no mistake, he is merciless, this gospel writer. He portrays them as blockheads all through the gospel. Remember, if you've read it? Jesus constantly struggling to get them to understand, the disciples not getting it. Not only do they not get it, they run away at the very end and abandon Jesus to his fate. I probably would have as well, seeing what was coming down. Well, by the end of the Passion narrative, the only supporters of Jesus, continuing on and willing to risk even being seen by his tomb, were the three women. Mark tells us they are Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome. It took courage just to show up at the tomb of an enemy of the state. But in Mark's abrupt, inconclusive ending, it seems that even the women let us down. They refuse the divine invitation to carry on the work that was started in Galilee. But from the ancient writer's perspective, who don't just wrap things up in a nice conclusion to entertain us, they wrote to change us, to move us to action. And in fact, that's why Mark's ending hangs, because we are needed to complete the story. It's up to us, with those women, to take up the invitation. Frankly, a story about an empty tomb didn't convince many people. It was just one more mystifying thing, like most of what Jesus was teaching. But over the next 50 days, a slow dawning, not a Shazam moment, but a slow dawning and felt sense of presence of the risen Christ, started to move those disciples out of their hiding places, back into public, back into their work of building the communities, the beloved communities, where we want to be. Part of the real miracle of Easter is those people could actually come out of hiding and carry on, knowing full well what might still happen to some of them. Well, what makes it possible, what made it possible for them to get back on the road, for any of us to get back on the road after a dream has died, a disappointment has leveled us, and we carry on? We don't turn to Mark for much help here. We turn to Paul. The Apostle Paul was the first to write about the risen Christ. And central to the rising was his experience of the grace and forgiveness of God that made it possible for Paul to carry on. Paul, in 1 Corinthians, gives the first recorded Easter message of shared risen life in Christ. He reminds us that while we're wrapped up in an ending, God is already bringing forward a new beginning. Sometimes it's just a vibration we start to feel, but it's not manifest yet. I'd like to share two stories of grace and forgiveness that can guide us. Samantha Cavanaugh is a member of our congregation and a first-year Emmanuel College student, and she writes this story. I was living in a L'Arche community in Alberta. L'Arche is a place where we seek to create community between people with and without developmental disabilities. I was helping Brad, one of our community, get ready for bed, when he made me promise that I would wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and make pancakes with him for the 9 people we lived with. But after I finished helping Brad get ready for bed, I stayed up sewing really late on my projects. And you know what? It was after 2 a.m. before I went to sleep. I set my alarm, and the next morning I hit the snooze button. And then I hit the snooze button again, and it was 8 o'clock. I could smell burning pancakes in the kitchen. Brad had started on his own. There was no nice pancake breakfast that morning, and when I came down to the kitchen, Brad had already left for his job. He'd left me a note, and it said, in bold print, "Sam, I am very sad that you didn't come to help with the pancakes. I will not talk to you for a few days. Love, Brad. This was a hard letter to receive. Brad is the kind of man who continually invites people into his life to share his passions and projects. And when he's disappointed, he's the kind of person who looks into himself for the reasons. Would you like to try making pancakes tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock? Instead of punishing me in silence, Brad extended his hand, and his love was stronger than his need to punish. We made pancakes the next morning, and it's for me a reminder that resurrection people find ways to make those pancakes together again. It's not too late to pick up the invitation to follow and serve. In fact, earlier in Mark's gospel, at Jesus' second healing, do you remember that he extends his hand to Simon's mother-in-law? She's in bed with a fever. And she rises up out of the bed, and the first thing she does is start to serve again. And the word, the verb used to serve there is the same one to use for Jesus being raised up out of the tomb. It's the same one. Rise up again and take up that invitation to serve life and each other. Well, Wendell Berry, known for his ecological poems, calls us to practice resurrection, just like you practice anything else. We practice for it even if the signs aren't there yet. We practice singing, we start picking up that banjo, but we can also practice resurrection. And that's looking for the and nudging the signs of new life to come, even where it doesn't seem possible. We can do that through art, through music. We can do that by showing up to a demonstration or a courtroom. We can do that by making a casserole. We can do that by making a jacket for someone you love the night before you go into the hospital for surgery. So with her permission, I tell the story of Imogene Walker, who, instead of packing her little bags for her knee surgery the night before, like any good patient did, was busily finishing that special jacket for Kay Fallis. She has sewn Kay a jacket out of a sweatshirt so it can be warm and cuddly in these still chilly times, but it's wild, wild poppies and flowers and colors, and so wild she doesn't think, Kay might not wear it to church, but knowing Kay, she might. But Imogene stayed up till 10 o'clock and made that jacket. And it's the first thing she talked about when I came to see her, because Lynn Stott promised to take that jacket to Kay Fallis. Imogene wasn't interested in the details of her surgery. She just couldn't wait to tell me that story about the jacket. And I thought, that is practicing resurrection. A story perhaps to what's happening in our world. There's a little country called East Timor. You remember hearing about it probably over those long 25 years of the struggle for independence, where 1 out of 10 people in East Timor died. It's a small place. Well, in 1996, Mr. Ramos Horta, Jose Ramos Horta, received the Nobel Peace Prize for being an exile for 24 years and writing about peace studies. In 2007, he was elected president, and in 2008, he was shot with 3 bullets. Evacuated to Darwin, Australia, he was put into a 10-day induced coma. When they brought him out, his first 2 immediate comments was first for the welfare of his people, and second, offering forgiveness to his assassin. Later, he said to the people, let us forget bad things that have happened in the past that divide and hurt us, and let us unite in peace and love so we can advance to a better future. Because of the continuity of this message and forgiveness right from his hospital bed, the capital city did not deteriorate into a frenzy of revenge, destabilization, and the institutions of state and the citizens showed a strong resilience, said the UN peacekeeper. In fact, the rebel group's deputy leader, a man named Susar, turned himself into the authorities. He was involved in the attack, with some reports suggesting he was the one who fired the shots. But Susar said, "I want this nation to be stable. If I don't surrender, this nation would never develop." Sounds like almost a fairy story in this world of unresolved conflicts, but no, it's true. And we can still look to small groups of people in this world struggling to practice resurrection. Maybe those women who were first at the tomb really did understand what was happening. They knew that when a divine messenger says, "Don't be afraid, you're about to get a big assignment." And they thought, "Oh no, not back on the road again." No. But sure enough, a big assignment was coming, and it was time to get back on the road and play their part. Sometimes the resurrection starts to creep up all around us and we're hardly aware of it because we hear the bad news. But last night I was in Peterborough, as I said, at my friend's Seder, which I go to every year. And their backyard is full of interesting things like rain barrels that collect rain and, you know, ecological systems that I haven't a clue how to implement. And then I read in online or the paper that, in fact, Peterborough is poised to become Canada's first official transition town. That means, in fact, that it's going to show how we can be sustainable communities that deal with peak oil issues. It's all set to go. They're fighting about it at City Council right now, which is a good sign, meaning it's about to pass. And all around us, that city has been preparing in a massive way to become an example. Well, the Gospel of Mark leaves the ending open so we can fill in the blanks with our own practice of resurrection. But we don't have to do it on our own. That's also part of the Easter story. Helpers come to roll away that stone. Those of you who are artists, and I can see a few of you here, might want to visit the Scarborough Foreign Mission out on the beautiful Scarborough Bluffs. And there is a huge concrete thing, some kind of building, I guess, that wasn't completely demolished. And there's a gorgeous mural of pictures of life in Chiapas. It's the Tzeltal people, an indigenous group. They had spent many months painting pictures of their suffering and the visible new life that they wanted to create. 2 days later, the Mexican police and the army smashed it down. But there was a few witnesses. They came back to Toronto, and last year, high school students and artists reproduced that mural. Not only did they reproduce everything on that mural, they added to it. It's quite stunning. Again, we rework the endings and we add to them. On Tuesday, many of us, Hans and I, walked over to Emmanuel College to the book launch of a book you all must read. It's called More Than Witnesses. It carries some of the history and story of our own Marian Pope and others who for years were mission partners in South Korea. Why is the book called More Than Witnesses? Well, in a very engaging and forthright way, the book tells the story of the Monday night group, just a modest group of mission partners, very small, that started to meet and talk about what was happening to their Korean neighbors and colleagues. Little did I know that South Korea had been in the grip of a brutal dictatorship all those same years that many of us followed what was happening in South and Central America. But nonetheless, that group started to get word out to the international community. And as Kim Dae-jung writes, who was president of the Republic of Korea from 1998 to 2003, as he writes in his introduction, "The efforts and devotion of the missionary community provided democratic activists, including me, a ray of light and a source of hope and courage. The inspiring achievements of these foreigners with hearts of Koreans have helped lay a firm groundwork in Korea for freedom, peace, and justice to come into bloom like pretty, tenacious, wild flowers. Kim Dae-jung was hidden in an attic by friends of mine, Lenore and Walter Beecham. Even their housekeeper did not know for 8 months. We all play our parts. And we don't quite know what part we're called to play, and we don't quite know who comes to roll away the stone, but we can trust at Easter it's already happening. So I want to close with a dream that a friend of mine had in her yoga class 2 years ago. She was a starving artist. You know the type? Any of you ever felt that way? Dedicated to her art, she was also a single parent. And she was a little tired of moving from apartment to apartment. The ones she liked, she couldn't pay the rent, and she couldn't afford to buy what she liked. But what she really wanted was a stable neighborhood and school for her son. And this really seemed like a big stone and block in her life. Everything else was going well. She had a dream one night, and it was her grandfather, Balfour, who appeared in the dream. And somehow in that dream, she had a sense that she was not alone lifting that stone. The next day, her real estate agent called, and I'm not kidding you, and said, "I found the house for you. It's on 112 Balfour Street." And it was perfect for her. You never know. God comes to us in mysterious ways. God comes to us in muted ways. And above all, God calls us to keep practicing resurrection. Amen.